From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. What an awful week this was for our economy. Again. On Thursday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average set another new low for the year. The S&P index dropped to its lowest point since 1997. New claims for unemployment soared, consumer prices sagged, and reporters labored to keep track of it all. Awful, and yet familiar to longtime financial reporter Michael Lewis. He's the editor of a new book called Panic, the Story of Modern Financial Insanity, out on December 1st. It looks back on five financial panics over the past 20 or so years, as well as the reporting done before, during, and after each meltdown. Compiling a book like this, Lewis says, is a lesson in pattern recognition.
The pattern tends to mirror the moods of the markets. So when the market is going up, regardless of however insane the reason for it going up, the patter in the press is very boosterish, optimistic, going along for the ride. Things go bad. The first thing that happens is there are recriminations in the press. But then the press turns to these pieces written with Olympian detachment after everything's come to grief. We always knew this was rotten. And you can't go back before the event and find anybody saying, very seldom anyway, that it was rotten. There's a lack of perspective to the first kind of coverage and a lack of really deep honesty to the second kind of coverage. In addition, people, when they're describing money, there's so much mystique around it and so much complexity has been added to the world of money. And everybody's afraid of not seeming to understand it. Everybody's afraid of asking the simple question, like, why does that make sense? Or could you explain that in English?
Is this level of complexity new?
Yes. It's gotten more and more and more complex over the last 30 years. It's harder and harder to really unpack it for a reader. And I've tried, you know, so I know. And I think the journalism for the last 6 or 8 months of this crisis has been pretty magnificent. But there is this, nobody wants to be stupid. You know, it's that once you're in the room with a Treasury secretary or the CEO of a Wall Street firm or even just some hotshot Wall Street trader, you don't want to seem like the idiot journalist who doesn't know what this is or why this works, because the natural response from the authorities is to ridicule you. But the obvious questions are usually really the best questions. So like the obvious question now, all right, Hank Paulson, Treasury secretary, you just gave $200 billion to banks to make loans. Banks that have proven they were bad at making loans because they would be bankrupt without you giving them money. Why give them the money? And you get back gobbledygook to preserve the financial order, restore stability. How does that restore stability? All it does is encourage the same bad behavior.
Are enough reporters asking that question now?
The problem is, in order to get on the other side of a desk from the Treasury Secretary to ask him that question, you have to have proven your unwillingness to ask that question. You know, I.F. Stone was great on this subject. He said, you know, I don't want to talk to the President of the United States because to get to that position where I'm allowed to talk to the President of the United States, I have to have compromised myself to such an extent I won't function.
If the behavior on Wall Street seems incapable of real improvement, do you think that the coverage of Wall Street is?
I think that when there's massive interest in Wall Street and people can do real well for themselves as journalists writing about Wall Street, the coverage gets better. After the bad things have happened. When the really good things are happening, the journalists tend to become bankers. I mean, that's literally true. And some of the great bashers of Wall Street of the past have, you know, Lou Dobbs, great populist. Lou Dobbs was swept up in the dot-com boom. He created space.com, started a front for Merrill Lynch. Journalists are as susceptible to the financial rewards as everybody else.
And then again, you occasionally find the bond trader who runs in the opposite direction into journalism.
When he knows he's a really bad bond trader.
Were you really?
I was perceived as a success, but they were mistaken. You see, they have a capacity for doing that.
You wrote your first book, Liar's Poker, after you departed from Wall Street, where you were a bond trader in the 80s. And you wrote in this month's portfolio that you intended that book to be a cautionary tale. So how'd that work out for you?
Not very well. I mean, it was my first lesson in the readers. You write one book and readers read whatever they want to read. I kind of hope that the young people who are thinking about going to walk on Wall Street, who pick up this book to see what it's really like, they read it and they say, well, I'll go do something more meaningful with my life. And instead, when the book came out, I mean, I was literally inundated with letters that said, Dear Mr. Lewis, I'm a senior at Ohio State University, and I read your book, How to Get Ahead on Wall Street. And I just hope you had some more tips for me, because I'm now really excited about going to work on Wall Street. Over the years, more people than you want to know tell me that the reason they went to work on Wall Street was they read Liar's Poker. So it had exactly the opposite effect. I probably should have known better.
Is the moral then that human nature is a force that always overwhelms unwelcome information?
Yes.
Does your research lead you to believe that we can never learn from our mistakes because of greed?
Yes. I think it's fair to say that in a way the financial markets have set out to demonstrate in the last 30 years that no matter how colossal a blunder you make, you're capable of making an even more colossal one just next year.
And all of these brilliant stories that have been written in the wake of the current disaster, all the cautionary tales contained therein, are they going to make a ripple?
Even people as hard-boiled as the typical Wall Street trader is gets his understanding of the world from some place. And a really well-written piece of journalism about Wall Street ends up being parroted back to you by lots of people on Wall Street who think they're being original. They read it, and that became their understanding of the world. So reporting does shape the thing's view of itself.
Even though in Panic you show how it didn't have a lasting effect over the five previous disasters.
Yes, even though. And I'll tell you what, even the difference is, before these were financial events that left everybody else largely untouched. In this case, it's a financial event that is going to touch everybody in America.
All right. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Michael Lewis is the editor of Panic, the story of modern financial insanity, to be published on December 1st, and the author of Liar's Poker.
Come January 20th, all eyes will be on President Barack Obama, and many of those eyes are eager to see what the secretive Bush White House has worked so hard to conceal, information that shed some light on the corridors of power. Nobody is more eager than the secrecy watchdog group, the National Security Archive, and the archive's general counsel, Meredith Fuchs, has a three-part to-do list for President Obama on his first day in office. Number one, reverse former Attorney General John Ashcroft's 2001 memo, which made it easier for the government to reject Freedom of Information Act requests by raising the bar for disclosing information. Fuchs says fixing the FOIA policy is priority number one.
We want President-elect Obama on day one to get rid of the Ashcroft memo and restore the presumption of openness.
All right. FOIA is one. What's number two?
Number two is presidential records. The Bush administration has lost something like 5 million emails in the White House because they have no archiving system. In addition, we don't even know whether Vice President Cheney's records are going to get transferred to the National Archives at the end of this administration. And we would like the new president to make clear that he will have better practices. And we would also like him to revoke an executive order that was issued by President Bush that allowed new privileges to apply to withhold historical presidential records.
Okay. And number three.
Number three, we would like to see a complete overhaul of the classification system. During the Bush administration, not only did classification numbers surge, more than doubling up to about 14 million. But the cost of the classification system has grown immensely to over $8 billion. And at the same time, the classification system has inhibited discussion of important issues. So, for example, many of the legal memos that justified torture, rendition, and warrantless surveillance have been classified as secret. From some of the records that have come out, we know that those classification decisions were not legitimate and they should never have been kept secret.
And it is explicitly illegal to use the classification process to save the government from embarrassment or political fallout.
Oh, yes. You cannot classify in order to protect the disclosure of illegality or to avoid embarrassment or for any of those reasons.
One of the inherent problems of extreme government secrecy is you don't know what the secrets are to try to get unclassified. It's kind of a chicken and egg proposition, isn't it?
That's certainly true, although one of the things that happens when you classify everything is you increase the leaks. People are much more likely to come forward with leaked information because they don't really have any respect for the classification label. There are people in government who think that the excessive secrecy is dangerous and who will try to come forward to report things.
We're speaking Wednesday. The buzz around Washington is that Eric Holder, the former U.S. attorney, will be named attorney general in an Obama administration. What's his resume on secrecy issues?
We're pretty hopeful, even though we don't know a lot about what he would do in specific cases. First of all, he served as deputy attorney general under Attorney General Reno, and Attorney General Reno had an outstanding policy on FOIA. Secondly, he comes from a public integrity and ethics background in his career. And when he was U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia, he actually apparently pushed back against efforts to avoid disclosure of the records of the Hillary Clinton health care task force. That's significant. There was also a somewhat controversial case involving records that were requested that related to some terrorists, where the Justice Department withheld them in part protecting the privacy interests of those terrorists. And Eric Holder, when he was U.S. attorney, made clear, we are not going to protect the privacy interests of terrorists. So those are a couple of good signs.
Now, obviously, the Bush administration was in a class by itself in obscuring its inner workings. But isn't the pattern that all administrations, and maybe even the Obama administration, discover once they're in office that, well, you know, a little bit of secrecy is not so bad? Do you expect President Obama to behave as president the way he campaigned?
One of the problems with people in power is they don't give up their power easily. And I think we're going to have to watch very closely to see whether the White House is going to give up any of those protections that the Bush administration asserted. I mean, that's one of the reasons it's so dangerous when you have a president who takes extreme positions, because once they establish the precedent, it's hard to know whether the next administration will really pull back.
Meredith, once again, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Meredith Fuchs serves as the general counsel to the National Security Archive.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Long before Michael Bloomberg was New York City's mayor, he was in the financial information biz. Nowadays, with such hires as former Time Inc. chief Norman Perlstein and former NBC president Andrew Lack, Bloomberg News looks like the news outlet most likely to succeed. It all began in the early 80s with the Bloomberg Terminal. Now there are nearly 300,000 of them, offering heaping helpings of financial data accompanied by analytics that offered traders new ways to process the information. But Bloomberg's clients needed news, too, so he bought feeds from Reuters and Dow Jones. That irked Bloomberg. Why pay others for something you can do yourself? As Seth Mnuchin recounts in December's Vanity Fair, Bloomberg phoned Wall Street Journal reporter Matthew Winkler for advice on how to go it alone. Since Winkler had already written about Bloomberg News, he had an answer ready when he picked up the phone.
Matt said, yeah, let's do it. You know, I'll come on board and I think we can start this thing and we can make it work. What he saw before his bosses at the Journal, before anyone at Reuters or Dow Jones saw it clearly, was that what Michael Bloomberg was trying to do really posed a threat to these two behemoths, Reuters and Dow Jones. Mm-hmm. For more than a century, they had been the rulers of their domain, essentially. And the notion to them that Bloomberg, as I put it in the piece, this 5'6" unemployed Jewish guy from Medford, Massachusetts, was going to come and pose a serious threat to them, I think never occurred to them.
Now, when Winkler came in, not only was he aware that he had this opening to create this whole new news service, but he brought in a few unconventional techniques. He over-covered stories. You describe something called the Goldilocks method and the five Fs, and he banned the use of the word but.
Right. So his Goldilocks approach was, he figured what they were covering was going to be time sensitive. It was going to be an earnings report. It was going to be something related to a press release. And they would know in advance when that was going to come. And he said, essentially, it's either going to be exactly what we expected, better than what we expected, or worse than what we expected. So if we essentially write those three stories before it happens, as soon as we get that release or that earnings report, bam, we can put this out on the wire. He hired a lot of very young reporters and essentially told them, you do it my way or you're going to pay the consequences. Yeah.
There are five W's, of course, in standard journalism.
Right.
Who, what, when, where, and why. Winkler had five F's.
Right. First, fastest, factual, final, and future. And all five of those had to be in not only in every story, but in the lead. And when you start to think about it that way, you can see how they could write these stories essentially in advance, how they could use the Goldilocks approach. And one of the reasons why they needed to do that was because he felt that being first was so important. He felt that in the financial community, either you're first or you're worthless.
And why ban the use of the word but or however?
Because it presented readers with conflicting information that was difficult for them to process. He essentially wanted a trader to be able to sit down at his desk and take a look at his screen and get everything he would need to know in a very quick snapshot. It was a notion of multitasking that wasn't really present at the time, that you should be able to do five different things and read a news article and not need to worry about getting confused.
So how do you get Bloomberg News?
You can get it two ways. You can get it because a newspaper that you read or a website that you read subscribes to the wire service. But to get the full array of what Bloomberg News offers, you need to be a terminal subscriber. Now, for really the first time, they are starting to look at diversifying their products and moving it slightly outside of the sort of terminal umbrella. An example of how that could work is right now, regional papers are not able to cover industry the way they used to. The San Jose Mercury News can't cover the tech industry the way it could 10 years ago. The Boston Globe can't cover biotech the way it used to. Bloomberg News could potentially go in, cover those industries, sell that content to the Boston Globe, to the San Jose Mercury News, and by putting it on their terminals, attract that many more subscribers from Boston or from San Jose. And I think one of the big questions right now is whether they will be able to do that and continue to be financially successful, or whether deviating from what has always been their sort of core mission is going to end up being problematic for them.
Well, this is what's interesting. Dan Doktoroff, who took over as president when Bloomberg's mayoral responsibilities took over his schedule, Doktoroff called the Bloomberg model the journalism as capitalism approach and told you that Bloomberg's not, quote, burdened by the old broken business models that almost every other news organization is.
What he meant was that the news division never made a financial decision that was not going to directly impact their readership. The New York Times' Iraq Bureau, which costs around $3 million a year. If they closed that bureau, the New York Times would not lose $3 million in revenue. Bloomberg News would never make that decision to spend that $3 million. They would look at Iraq and say, how many of our customers would either subscribe or stop their subscription if they don't get this information? So there's always that very direct relationship at Bloomberg.
Here's the money line from your story, I think, Seth. You wrote, for the moment at least, it looks as if we're moving towards a world in which more people will get their information from Bloomberg News than from any other single source. Really?
Well, right now, Bloomberg News has more editorial employees than the New York Times and the Washington Post combined, which, when I found out, astounded me. Because they are not dependent on models that clearly are not working, advertising-based, subscription-based models. And just in the last several weeks, we've seen a complete bloodbath at magazines and newspapers around the country. The largest newspaper in New Jersey almost closed, which is astounding. And Bloomberg News is not only not being killed, but is still doing active expansion.
But you seem to forecast, in a way, a time in which our dominant news source may be news through a business-conscious lens.
As news organizations have stumbled, non-traditional media organizations or non-traditional models are starting to fill in that void. You have ProPublica, the investigative outfit, which is now collaborating with television programs and newspapers, and that's a nonprofit. In terms of having an army of reporters, I think that increasingly we're going to see places like Bloomberg News, and we're going to see that coming from not just the financial news world, but a completely different base economic model.
Seth, thanks very much.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Seth Mnookin's story, Bloomberg Without Bloomberg, is in the December issue of Vanity Fair.
So if Bloomberg is counting on pure capitalism to support new models for reporting, other news outlets are relying on your generosity. Small, web-only, not-for-profit newsrooms, recently profiled in the New York Times, are springing up around the country and scooping much larger dailies. Take, for example, voiceofsandiego.org, which has a staff of just 10, but has managed in just a few years to uncover a series of local government scandals. Executive editor Scott Lewis says that San Diego used to be a three-newspaper town, but now, with only the Union Tribune surviving, there's a reporting void to fill. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Luckily for you, there is a deep vein of corruption running through city government. And fairly early on, you hit the mother lode. Can you tell me about the Redevelopment Authority story?
California has a pretty ambitious redevelopment law that allows cities to invest tax money back into the community. And one of the agencies in charge of this area was the Southeastern Economic Development Corporation in the southeast part of San Diego, which is traditionally a community that struggled. And, you know, over a course of 2 years, basically, we did some major investigations. And finally, this summer, we pulled out a story about how the person in charge was actually giving a clandestine system of bonuses to her and her top staff, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And since then, the person in charge has been ousted. The second in charge has been ousted. The whole board has been reformed. And now there's a grand jury that we just discovered is investigating from D.C., actually, from the Justice Department.
What effect did that have on your traffic?
We go through periods where our traffic goes up in the plateaus and then goes up again in plateaus, and that was one of the points where it went up.
And what effect did it have on how quickly people returned your reporters' calls?
I think what it did was show what power we could have as far as our investigative prowess. The very moment that story came out, the mayor issued a memo where he said, "I read the voiceofsandiego.org story today. You have some serious questions to answer. Answer them within this certain period of time." And that forced the local newspaper, the Union Tribune, to respond as well. That forced the local TV stations to mobilize. Our goal isn't to get readers. Our goal is to get these stories out. And, you know, obviously we need readers to do that. But if somebody takes our stories and puts them on the local radio station or on the TV station or whatnot, that's what differentiates us as a nonprofit from a for-profit.
Well, many have suggested that the only future for daily newspapers is not as for-profit businesses, but as a kind of equivalent to public broadcasting, where they have many revenue sources and are deemed community services that everybody has a stake in. Do you see yourself as the leading edge of the future of daily journalism?
Yeah, we're trying to blaze that trail right now. You know, information is a public service. And we've been lucky in many ways for decades, even centuries, to have it subsidized by advertising, by people who wanted to get their message in the middle of whatever public service was being performed. But that's gone. When was the last time you looked at page A7 of a major daily newspaper and said, "Wow, those are some great tires. I need to go buy those tires"? It's just not happening as much. And so our purpose was to try to salvage the public service that was in journalism and do it more efficiently by taking out the printing costs of the newspaper, and then also focus it in on a mission that we were going to cover the things that really matter, the government, and hold the government accountable. And, you know, we're not going to spend a lot of effort just telling the stories that get us the hits, that we're going to tell the stories that fulfill that mission.
I want to ask you one last thing. Local journalism, cultural and public affairs, a lot of people are going to be fighting for that territory, whether it's the existing daily newspaper, the alt-weekly, the public radio station, the local TV stations, everybody is going to be fighting for the same space. Do you view yourself in competition with San Diego's public radio station, with the Union Tribune, with the Alt Weekly? I mean, are you hoping to somehow carve out the whole market for yourself?
No. You know, one of the things that's kind of scary is that we were hired to sort of help fill this gap between the needs of the community and what was being provided. And so we have been kind of overwhelmed by the fact that that gap has grown. You know, the Union Tribune won a Pulitzer Prize not too long ago, and the person who won it has just been let go and is working for a nonprofit, actually, the ProPublica in Manhattan. But we don't look at the demise of newspapers with at all any kind of glee. What we're doing is trying to provide a model for how a community can respond. And around the country, you know, Minnesota and Chicago and New Haven and St. Louis, they're all seeing the same thing and turning to nonprofit online journalism as an answer.
Well, Scott, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Scott Lewis is executive editor of voiceofsandiego.org. Some stories come and go in a news cycle. Some linger forever, and some reemerge periodically, like the bloom of the Titan Arum plant or the census. Tuesday marked the 30th anniversary of the Jonestown Massacre, the orchestrated death of more than 900 members of the People's Temple, a cult led by Jim Jones. Also killed that day was California Congressman Leo Ryan, who had gone to Jonestown, Guyana, on a fact-finding mission. Tim Reiterman, then a reporter for the San Francisco Examiner, went with Ryan and was shot twice in the ambush that left Ryan dead. Reiterman has written for the 10th, 20th, 25th, and now 30th anniversaries of the massacre, trying to correct public misconceptions of the killings as he recalls that horrible day.
Those of us covering the congressman's trip left in a temple dump truck for a nearby airstrip. When we arrived and began boarding two small planes, a tractor and trailer full of temple gunmen pulled up, and they leapt out and began firing at us. As I took cover behind one of the plane's wheels, I was wounded, but fortunately was able to jump up and run into the nearby jungle. When I came out minutes later, I found that the congressman and three of my fellow newsmen had been killed.
Now, this is one of those stories that captures the world's attention and horror. And then it just eventually kind of fades away. How odd is it for you to, at least as far as Jonestown is concerned, disappear off the face of the earth for five-year cycles and then return like a cicada to retell the story?
Well, I have never been a big fan of anniversary stories. In this case, I think the event was important enough that at least the 10-year cycles were suitable. As time has gone on, it's become more difficult, in part because you have to put the survivors through this ordeal of reliving the events again and again. But on the other hand, I believe it's important to continue to write about Jonestown because the world still is operating under a number of misconceptions. One of them is that the people were simply robotic cultists, and there's no recognition of the fact that they were mostly ordinary people from all walks of life who joined for the best of motives. They wanted to help their fellow man. And many people still don't understand that what happened in Jonestown was not a clean-cut, voluntary ritual led by Jim Jones. It was really a mass murder that he orchestrated.
As a reporter, putting aside what you personally experienced to have to go back into some of these horrifying memories, what do you face opening up those wounds for others who maybe aren't that interested in going through this?
Particularly this year, as I was working on my 30th anniversary piece for the Associated Press, I ran into people with whom I'd spoken before who didn't want to be interviewed yet again. And I ran into, more often, a number who said, "This is the last time I'm going to be interviewed."
While memories of Jonestown may fade over now three decades, it has found its way into the popular lexicon because of one particular phrase. How do you react when you hear people use the expression quite blithely, they drank the Kool-Aid?
Well, I find that offensive to the victims as well as to the survivors, because it's come to mean unthinking loyalty, something less than human. What happened in Jonestown was Jones, when he started this ritual, he surrounded that community with armed guards, with crossbows. And when he ordered that potion to come forward, he ordered the children to go first. By doing that, he sealed everyone's fate, because the parents and other elders would have no reason to live once the young ones died. That was a diabolical final step in what really was mass murder.
Tim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Tim Reiterman is the Associated Press's Northern California news editor. His book, Raven, The Untold Story of the Reverend Jim Jones and His People, was just released in paperback.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We've been reading your emails, and we have something to correct. Last week, in a segment about car culture, Bob mentioned that the A-Team drove a Camaro. Turns out, they drove a van. As Evan wrote to us, how would you fit an entire team from the Los Angeles Underground in a Camaro? Good point.
Our discussion of victim impact statements, short videos sometimes scored with music to convey for a jury the human impact of a crime, prompted this response from Eric Williams in Omaha. Last year, my best friend and roommate was killed by a drunk driver. During the court case, people suggested that I write a victim's impact statement specifically to be used against the driver in his trial. The loss of my friend was more painful than anything I've ever experienced. But Williams says that he opposes such statements because they place value judgments on the lives of the victims rather than the severity of the crime. Quote, if a homeless person were the victim instead, who would write the victim impact statement? Why should that offender receive a lesser punishment than the driver who took my friend? Manipulating the emotions of the court to achieve vengeance doesn't improve the judicial system or provide emotional healing for the victim's family and friends.
On a different subject, David Grambling of Berkeley wrote in with this. I'm delighted, among the other things I'm delighted about with OTM, that Garfield keeps imitating his wife on the air. It's bold, humane, groundbreaking. Don't let anyone tell you different.
Charles Cates also wrote wondering if my wife knows that I make her sound like Natasha from Rocky and Bullwinkle. Well, she does, although I played her one of the cartoons and she said, Garfield, why it is that moose sounds ridiculous?
Keep the emails coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and if the spirit moves you, phone us at 646-829-4590 to leave a message about why you listen to the show. If you do, we may use your voice in an on-air promo. If you didn't catch the number, you can find it, along with free transcripts and MP3 downloads, at onthemedia.org. And thanks for the good word, if you have one. In 2005, Dr. John Ioannidis made waves in the scientific community when he charged that most published scientific research later turns out to be false. So last month in The Economist magazine, he laid the blame at the door of the scientific journals that published that research, saying that the spread of false information is due to something called the winner's curse. Dr. Ioannidis, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
I know that the winner's curse is just one of the factors that you cite, but what is the winner's curse? Isn't that term usually applied to the winners of auctions?
In economics, the winner's curse means that when you have lots of people making bids for an auction, the person who eventually wins probably has overpaid. If one could estimate the average of all the bids, that might be closer to the real value of the commodity.
And you say that that is exactly what's going on in scientific journals, and the curse is simply the curse of publishing wrong information.
It's the curse of publishing exaggerated and possibly sometimes completely wrong information. Now, in scientific circles, currently in many fields, there's lots of research teams generating results on the same research question. Their average results, if you have 20 or 30 or 50 teams, probably reflect the truth. However, if only what are the most striking results eventually end up being published, especially in the most high visibility journals, these selected results are likely to suffer from a similar winner's curse.
You've also found a bias towards publishing positive results, right? Do you have an example of that?
There's several studies in the literature that suggest that when you have studies that have been equally well designed and equally well conducted, the ones with positive results will be printed far more frequently or they will be published far more quickly. For example, there's an empirical study that looked at studies on antidepressants. About half of them had found positive results in favor of the drugs, and another half of them or so found negative results, no effectiveness, the drug didn't seem to make a difference compared to placebo. However, the published literature on these drugs is comprised entirely of positive studies.
So the obvious question is, why? Is it just that scientific journals are subject to the same commercial pressures that all other journals are and they just have to move paper?
I think that this is part of the truth. There's a lot of competition, and I think that any journal is interested to publish research that does seem to matter and does seem to make a difference, and something that other journals have not published.
What's the overall impact of all of these exaggerated scientific stories in the journals?
The impact could be very substantial. For example, if we're talking about research that deals with whether treatments are effective or not, if the literature is distorted, that means that we believe that some treatments are worth it and they are effective, while in fact they're not, or that they're more worth it and more effective than they actually are. It could lead a whole field of researchers down the wrong path. One could have what we call herding, where someone publishes a paper in a major journal, and then everybody has to try to work on that field and try to find similar results so as to be trendy, so as to attract funding, so as to seem that one is working in research that is attractive and it was published in that major journal, so why not me as well?
So what's the fix?
Well, that you don't publish just the results of one team that came up with a very spectacular result, but you publish together the results of that team along with the results of another 5 or 10 or 20 and sometimes even more teams who are working on the same question. And we could ask for journals to be more interested into publishing results that are negative or refuting original observations that seem to have been exaggerated.
You've done some really spectacular research that, as a matter of fact, has been accepted by scientific journals. And The Economist magazine ended its piece about you with an intriguing question for you, which is, now that your latest work has been accepted by a journal, is that reason to doubt it?
I think that all of my research is open to criticism and refutation. And I think that this is just part of the process of science. So we make some hypotheses, we generate some data, and these are open to verification or refutation. So, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Ioannidis is an epidemiologist at the Ioannidis School of Medicine in Greece. As he said, the more researchers you have, the better results you're likely to get. That's why Netflix offered a $1 million prize to whomever can figure out how to improve by 10% the software that makes movie recommendations to Netflix customers. You'd think it would be a simple matter of compiling their past preferences, but that only gets you so far. As Clive Thompson explains in this weekend's New York Times Magazine, there's an impenetrable mystery at the heart of our predilections. But it's a mystery that the Netflix program called Cinematch has to penetrate if it wants to succeed.
Almost two-thirds of all movies they rent are picked because people had it recommended by the computer. Now, that seems like almost kind of crazy when you think about it, but it makes sense because, like, when I joined Netflix, I had like 20 movies I wanted to see. So I saw those. And once I'm done, I can't really think of any other movies I want to see. So if they want to keep on charging me $17 a month, they have to be active in helping me find new stuff, or I'll go 4 or 5 months without renting any movies, and they'll be like, why am I spending $17 a month, right? Their business model is incumbent upon keeping you renting movies.
So how's this contest going? What can their data tell them at this point?
Well, it's interesting. Within about 1 month of the competition, all these amateurs, and they're mostly amateurs, had gotten 5% better. So they, like, right off the bat, they're 5% better. And they did this with just a couple simple mathematical techniques. One of them is called singular value decomposition. It's very common. Like, mathematicians use this all the time to take huge sets of data and try and find interesting patterns in it, but no one had ever thought to use it for movies. It's a way of sort of automatically trying to find what they call features in a data set. Now, what that translates to in movies is it'll look at the movies and automatically try and pull out features.
And for an example, one would be comedy.
And
another feature might be they all have Tom Hanks.
Yeah, yeah. And you can sometimes, when you look at this feature set, you can figure it out. So you'll see a list, and it's like all these chick flicks at one end, and then all these action films at the other. So you're like, well, clearly it's discovered something that sort of arrays these movies based on, you know, chick flickiness. That way it can sort of recommend it based on doing the same thing for the user. It sort of figures out how chick flicky are you as a user. Well, here's the movies that are chick flicky, and it lines you up that way. But as they got better and better at doing this, when you look at some of these features, you can't figure out what, for goodness sake, the computer is figuring out, because there's just like a bunch of movies at one end and a bunch of movies at the other end, and it doesn't make any sense at all. I look at this one feature set. It had like a wrestling video and a chick flick and a historical drama, and all clumped together as if there was something similar with these. So it's like the computer is finding something out about us that we ourselves can't even figure out.
Which I think is a good time to bring up Napoleon Dynamite. Why is that film significant?
Well, Napoleon Dynamite is really interesting because what happened is these guys, they came out of the gate and they were very quickly able to get like 5% better than Netflix. But it took like another 6 months to get to 6%. It took like a year to get to 7%. They've been 2 years in now. And they have been slowing down. So like they've just been stuck at about 9.5% for like 6 months. They're just inching up. It's almost like you're climbing a mountain that's getting steeper and steeper as you go. And so I asked them, I said, why? And they said, well, basically the problem is there's this small handful of movies that are causing most of our errors. You know, so like basically they're movies that we can't seem to predict whether or not you're going to like it. And it turns out that there's one movie that is generating 15% of the errors. So if you could figure out whether or not someone likes this movie accurately, you would be 15% of the rest of the way to making $1 million. And that movie is Napoleon Dynamite. They cannot seem to predict whether or not you're going to like it.
Because it's so weird?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I asked them. I said, so why? Why this? And I should point out that the other sort of 20-odd movies that are causing the other half of that error rate are very similar. They're all these weird movies like I Heart Huckabees or, you know, Team America World Police or, you know, Sideways. These indie movies and I said, so why? And they said, well, the problem is with these movies, people either love them or they hate them. Like, you take a movie that's easy to predict, like Lord of the Rings, you know, it tends to get mostly the same rating. Or you take a movie that even people don't like, you know, but it's like a genre movie, like a chick flick, you know, a bad chick flick like The Black Book. It tends to get mostly bad reviews. Like, people agree on it. The problem with these movies is nobody agrees. It's all 5 stars and 1 stars. And when you have that sort of data signal, it's very confusing for the computer. It just cannot quite figure out how to recommend the movie.
But as you say, that, you know, that last half a percentage point to the 10% improvement that wins you the $1 million prize seems to be almost a vanishing point.
Yeah, yeah.
Because measuring taste with perfect accuracy is apparently an impossible dream, no matter how much data we have to work with. Films and books and music are art, and their appeal is, in some cases, ineffable, right?
Well, one way to look at the problem is that, like, what Netflix is asking the computers to do is look at all your past ratings and predict how you're going to like something in the future, right, that you haven't seen. But the problem is that, you know, our taste sort of changes over time. It's not static, or, you know, it often changes. And the way it changes is in these very unpredictable ways. Maybe you interact with someone who convinces you to look at a movie, or maybe you read something, or maybe you just get interested in something that you would never see otherwise because your friends are interested in it. And so it's very hard to capture those types of things algorithmically. And that's why a lot of people have said, well, maybe there's only so far you can push this idea that the computer can sort of put us on the couch and sort of, you know, psychologically figure what we're doing. Maybe you need to bring other live people in. Like, you need to have sort of a Facebook application that says, you know, here's what your friends are watching. You know, maybe you should take some cues from that. Maybe that's how you'd sort of solve the Napoleon Dynamite problem, because you use sort of the social mob in addition to the computer science angle.
We heard in the interview that just preceded ours how the recipe for accurate scientific research is transparency and crowdsourcing, at least joining together, pooling the information of a bunch of researchers working on the same problem. Now, Netflix has applied this lesson in structuring its Cinematch contest. Clearly, that's making a difference, right?
There seems to be a very sort of almost like civil or academic tone to what's going on, because as soon as someone discovers something, they'll sort of go onto the Netflix discussion boards for this and excitedly talk about it. They'll put computer code up on this board saying, hey, I just discovered this. So that has also sped things up, because all the innovators will see what everyone else is doing and they can all try it out. So it's been very, very sort of a very exciting thing to watch, you know, in a lot of ways.
So you've said the only way really to get to that 10% improvement or more is to bring real people back into the process. It's not likely, right, that Netflix or Amazon or any of these commercial websites will be doing that in a systematic basis. What are the stakes if they can't master the art of predicting our tastes better?
Well, I mean, to a certain extent, you could say that they actually have enjoyed great success. They've already taken a lot of the things that these guys have figured out. They've already folded them into their recommendation system, so they're already going to start making millions more. But the reason why this is important is because you've got this media world where you have way more stuff than anyone can ever pick from. This is what they call the paradox of choice. If you have too many choices, you'll sort of get frozen. You'll choose nothing. Music is an even bigger problem than films, because films, you know, a finite number come out every year, a couple hundred, a couple thousand. But, you know, that's as many songs as get issued on a day, right? So the music industry is to a certain extent, in even more of a lather to figure this one out, because, you know, their industry is in a complete free fall, and they're pretty convinced that the only way to cut through the noise is to be able to push people towards the right music. And so they have this very interesting heated argument about that falls along the same lines as to whether it should be done by computers or by humans, you know, because some people say, well, computers are the only way that you could look at these millions and millions of songs that are coming out every year and find patterns in them. Other people are like, no, that's not going to work. If you really want to get people addicted to things, you've got to have humans guiding them.
You quote in your piece someone who says, you know, there are cultural consequences to limiting yourself to computer data crunching to help guide people's opinions. It creates narrow-mindedness.
Yeah. Well, one of the problems is, and this is sort of an interesting philosophical point. Again, if you say that, okay, Clive Thompson, I'm going to recommend things based on what you've seen in the past, I'm getting sort of the Clive Thompson universe. But I like a lot of sci-fi, I like a lot of nerdy things, so I'm not going to go out and see the things that are mainstream, right? And maybe that's a problem, because I'm going to start being out of touch with what my friends are talking about, you know? Another way of putting it is that whether or not you like a piece of culture may not be the most compelling reason to see it. You know, maybe there are other reasons to encounter culture other than whether or not you like it. Maybe it's almost like, you know, eat your beans. You know, you should pay attention to some of this stuff if you want to know what's going on in society. And so how in God's name are you going to get a computer algorithm to say, I'm going to recommend something that I'm pretty sure you won't like, but I think you should see?
Only your friends can get you to eat your beans.
That's right.
Clive, thank you very much.
No problem. Good to be here.
Clive Thompson's article about Netflix and Cinematch is in this weekend's New York Times Magazine.
Hey, Napoleon, what'd you do all last summer again?
I told you, I spent it with my uncle in Alaska, hunting wolverines.
Did you shoot any?
Yes, like 50 of them. They kept trying to attack my cousins. What the heck would you do in a situation like that?
What kind of gun did you use?
A freaking 12-gauge. What do you think?
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and Michael Bernstein, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Dina Pritchep and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.